so to your point of it takes a village, I think the best way to address all of this is with like a community level approach, yes, where we true have true parents united in the...
Steve Furlock for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, available anywhere, anytime, on the internet, in your browser, WFPR.FM, or in the local Franklin Mass FM radio dial. Yeah, the dial or the push buttons, 102.9. Mark that. That's the number. Here in the office today, actually their office, not the studio office, their office today, with Dr. Carolyn Cuno. How are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm really good. How are you, Steve?
You know, we're about to have a good conversation, so I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Great.
And Dr. Cindy Ballou.
I'm so happy to have you here. We're very excited to kind of tell you all about what we do and to spread the good word.
This is what we're about to do for sure.
Love that.
Yes, yes. That was a great segue. So Steve is saying, well, he's talking to a couple of doctors. Who are they? What kind of doctors are they? So why don't we start with you and just give us a little background on you and then how you got into this role.
Sure. So I'm Dr. Carolyn Cunell. I'm a licensed psychologist here in the state of Massachusetts. And I primarily do neuropsychological testing. I do a bit of therapy and parent training, parenting support work as well, but primarily neuropsychological evaluations. It was kind of a long road to get here. It's not easy to get a doctorate and a license in psychology, but it's been a really rewarding path.
Good. Yes, that's and it's a challenging space these days. Apparently there's not enough of you and there's consistent demand.
Yes, that's very true. I think there's a lot of children and adolescents, parents, families in need of mental health support, and there's not enough providers to go around. I think there's also not enough providers taking insurance, so that makes it really hard for families to access care.
Yeah.
But we are doing our best to meet the need for families here in Franklin and surrounding communities as well.
Yeah, and we'll get into that a little bit more as we go. And
okay, I'm Dr. Cindy Ballou. So I've actually been with Dr. Cunell for, I think, coming up on 8 years. So I actually fell in with Dr. Cunell my third year of graduate school, at which time she terrified me because of her precision. And over the years, obviously, I've gotten to know that that precision is actually like executing practice work, clinical work to a T because she cares so much, which is why, again, I've been with her for 8 years. So I'm also a licensed psychologist in the state of Massachusetts. My background was initially in therapeutic work. I work with kids of all ages, 4 to 22, but I really love the teenagers. They keep you on your toes. They will really make you question your fashion choices. But again, I love them. I love them in and out. But again, so my background was in therapy. But over time, again, being with Dr. Cunell, my love of neuropsych has grown and grown. So now that's actually my primary role as well. We try to divide and conquer. I know that Dr. Cunell has kind of preferences from clinical perspective, as do I. We see everybody, but again, I really like working with our adolescents.
Mm-hmm.
She really enjoys working with our little guys.
I love the little ones. Yeah. I really do. I enjoy seeing our preschool and elementary age kiddos, especially those who are struggling with managing big feelings and big behaviors at home.
Right.
I just feel like there's such an opportunity to put tools and resources in the hands of parents at that young age and really have an impact on their development.
Certainly, yeah.
So that's really rewarding.
Now, the easy question, we can go from there too, but post-COVID more so than pre-COVID?
It's a great question. I feel like we've seen some different trends, and I'll let Dr. Ballou speak to our teenagers because that's who she sees most.
Right.
But the little ones, we are seeing a lot more emotional and behavioral dysregulation in our younger kids. I think that those COVID years, despite the fact that we're 5 years past it now, right? They had a pretty significant impact for many of our students who didn't have opportunities for socialization mm-hmm. or who were maybe sort of experiencing more inconsistent parenting practices
because things were changing all the time. So, you know, trying to have a set routine, which is always critical at those early days, was going to be hazardous because you couldn't count on things. Things were changing all the time.
Exactly. And so, depending on what developmental stage kids were in when COVID hit, I feel like it affected them in different ways. And our babies that were born in 2020 are now in kindergarten, which is a really interesting context for, you know, conceptualizing their development and what opportunities they had in those mm-hmm. early years to develop skills for self-regulation, exposure to early literacy, time with caregivers. There's a lot of different factors mm-hmm. at play, which we try to take into consideration when we're doing our evaluations.
Yeah, because I think, and I may be surmising, but from other conversations in a similar space, it's better to fully understand kind of the environment to deal with the person in that environment.
100%. And I think that that's what makes the neuropsych evaluation process so helpful for families. And for listeners who don't really know what that might consist of, it's a four-part process where we do a really thorough clinical interview with the family. Mm-hmm. We have two testing sessions with the child that are usually 2 to 3 hours in length. So we're spending close to six hours with a child in the office here doing different activities. And then we do a parent feedback session where we explain all of the results to the family. And then we write up a very lengthy detailed report that they can use to advocate for their child. Mm-hmm. So we're using the data that we collect in session, but we're putting that in a broader context of what's happening in their environment at home, what's happening in their environment at school, what's been their history. We take mm-hmm. into consideration sort of, you know, birth history, early development, medical interventions, you know, everything that has impacted their development to help families understand what's going on at this point in time.
Right, because I think, and the generalization is, well, we did this, I grew up like this. Most people are going to do that. Mm-hmm. And that's not the case.
I think we often find, at least I know that this happens for me in neuropsych feedback meetings, particularly with the teenagers that I see, is that I'll start to kind of go through the data and explain that, you know, if we're mapping this onto their, you know, early childhood, you know, XYZ is the reason why your child behaved in ABC reasons. And as we kind of go through, the number of times where I hear parents say, I think you're describing me, or you know, kind of the laugh of like, I wish that I had had this when I was in mm-hmm. high school. There's very much an apple tree feeling to this.
Yep.
For better and for worse, I want to say for the most part for better, because I think that not only do students, I'm thinking adolescents in general, feel like they've been heard, they've been understood, but now they have an opportunity to kind of tell parents like, see, I told you, in the best possible way. I think mm-hmm. one of the things that we really find is that if we can give parents a deeper understanding of why their adolescent acts in the ways that they do, makes the choices that perhaps are not ones that they want them mm-hmm. to be making. If we can help them understand why, it creates such a bridge for better communication. And again, I mean, adolescence in general is a time where kids want to separate and do separate from their parents. They're trying to figure out who they are. And that's a scary process at the best of times. So if we can put...
That's where the teens, and I do have some background there because I was going to be one of the world's greatest English teachers, secondary ed, so middle
There's
school,
still
high
time.
School.
There's still time.
not for me. I would have to go back to school for much more than I want to at this point. But yeah, they're growing, clearly. They're developing along that way. And then they're starting to get that independence. And sometimes that independence is, no. But there needs to be an agreement between and amongst.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think sometimes what we also find is that we want to kind of give reasonable expectations.
Yeah.
So sometimes for parents, that's kind of reassurance that like your child is gonna have like bumps and bruises along the way because that is part of life. But as a parent of a teenager, you have this beautiful opportunity right now to have them under your wing and allow them to experience those bumps and bruises.
Sure.
Because that's what's going to happen in the real world. And then to be there to help them kind of navigate it. And I think that in a post-COVID world, one of the things that we're seeing more and more frequently is that parents want to shield and protect their child from everything.
Correct.
Which is totally reasonable. It's your child.
It's a natural reaction.
Exactly.
But it's probably the wrong reaction.
Exactly.
Under the circumstances.
Exactly. So to kind of help parents to see that, like, your kid can do it. They're going to have bumps and bruises, and we want them to. Like, that is how you learn. That's how you grow. And again, I think that sometimes parents feel afraid that they're not allowed to let their child fail. And I think one of the beautiful things that we can do is to remind them that, no, it's really important that you let your child fail within reason.
Yeah, because it may be a trite, but you learn from failure. Mm-hmm. And clearly it needs to be structured. Mm-hmm. It needs to be, you know, safe, which is why you have schools with that environment in order to learn math or languages, in the playground handling bullies, etc. Those are still environments to deal with.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, I think that one of the things that we do in our kind of parent work, so again, the bulk of our caseload is neuropsych evaluations. Both Dr. Cunell and myself have kind of small caseloads for both like individual therapy as well as parent support work.
Okay.
And I think one of the things that we work really, really hard on is to help parents give themselves permission to be a little bit more hands-off. And it's really hard for parents.
Yeah.
I think historically what you're describing has been a pretty common teenage adolescent phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm seeing with a lot of my little ones is that it's that desire to protect and to limit these sort of risky experiences that are still developmentally appropriate has trickled down to these younger experiences that kids also really need, where I see families pulling their kids out of sports because the meltdowns at the soccer field feel really uncomfortable for parents. And while I totally understand it, when your kid's melting at the soccer field, laying in the middle of the field, refusing to play,
you're kind of exposed.
You feel like your kid's the only one. It's really hard. It's uncomfortable.
It's not a laughing moment, but yeah, we can all recognize
it. Right. Like, most parents can relate to that.
Sure.
But what I try to coach parents through is look around next time we're at the soccer field because there's 10 other kids doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
maybe
that's
not expressing it exactly that way, but they're doing something along that scale.
Yeah. Like there's supposed to be a lot of hard experiences in early childhood, and it's through those moments that kids learn how to tolerate feelings of discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's easy to want to protect your kids from feelings of sadness or, you know, worry or anxiety or disappointment or embarrassment. Like, we don't want our kids to experience these negative emotions, but experiencing them and realizing that you can come out the other side and be okay is such an important learning opportunity for kids, and giving your kids that experience is such a gift, because if you can develop that distress tolerance early, it sets you up for so much more success in the teenage years.
And what I have often found is that parents say, oh, great, that sounds wonderful. How?
What do I do?
And one of the things that I often hear, which is kind of a big piece of misinformation, is that parents of children who are demonstrating anxiety to one degree or another are being told, well, set a schedule. Tell them exactly what's gonna happen. Walk them through it. And parents are being told to essentially outline every single detail of what their child is about to go through, when the great irony is that that is gonna make it way worse.
Right.
There is no way that you can ever predict all of what's going to happen.
Something will happen, and if you at least said, you know, one or two, or maybe give some options along the way, now you've couched it a little bit. So if it's not going to be this, it may be that, as opposed to it's always going to be this way, forget it, you're gonna fail somewhere.
Well, the great irony is that there will always be another what if. I mean, if you want to see how creative a kid can be, have them be anxious, and then have them ask a parent a question like, okay, well, is little, you know, Johnny gonna be there? I don't know, he might be. Like, yeah, let's say that he's going to be. Okay, well then what do I do?
Right.
Well, we'll see when you get there. Well, yeah, but what if I say the wrong thing? Well, you might. That's okay. Okay, well, but then there will always be another
right.
what if.
Right.
And
right.
there's really only one way to yeah. stop that, which is to say, like, I know that you're feeling anxious, and I know that you're feeling icky. Like, it doesn't feel good. Your body feels icky when mm-hmm. you're anxious. But I've seen you go through hard things. I've seen you tolerate this before.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what happens, I know you're going to get through it.
Right.
And parents have to be a broken record with that.
Yeah, and it's not the end of the world for one thing. Mm-hmm. Even if it goes Dixie or bad or whoever you want to call it, you can recover.
Mm-hmm. Always.
There's still yep. tomorrow. The sun
Always.
Will rise tomorrow.
Yes. Always. Absolutely. Yep.
Like, and it'll be two ways, right? Because the kid will have known. Mm-hmm. And then, oh, by the way, you hopefully will recognize that, oh, I probably shouldn't do that next time.
Absolutely. It's a learning curve for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely.
And being willing and humble to take that learning curve.
Absolutely.
You know, without fastening the seatbelt to the nth degree.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because there will always be another what if that will get in under the seatbelt, whether you like it or not.
Right. Right.
I think that's one thing that we try to do here for families is help them realize that learning curve is okay.
Mm-hmm.
That
right.
they're not supposed to have it all figured out. That child development is a process. There's no finish line. And built into our neuropsych process is a lot of time with parents to really help them understand what their kid's going through. Like, it doesn't just end with a diagnosis or a label
right.
and, you know, a bulleted list of five steps and out the door you go. Like, we really try to help families walk away with a deeper understanding of how their family can function more peacefully moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And whenever we can, we offer follow-ups to families
sure.
too. So to your point about it being difficult to access care, it is, but I feel like there's definitely more opportunity now than there was when we were in the thick of COVID.
True, yeah. COVID limitations itself just complicated the process to begin with. Yes.
Yeah, and I hear families say now, you know, that wait lists are, you know, years long, and that's not true anymore. We
mm-hmm.
do have families that can spend a couple days, 1 week, really putting time and energy and effort into calling around, and you can find a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are people with openings now.
Right. So there is
just,
hope.
It's wanting to take that
right.
step
yeah.
and being committed.
Well, and unfortunately, I think society, you know, use that as a generalization, and I know it's not, but society wants things right now, and they want the answers, and if the Dr. Spock book was perfect, we'd still be using it, but we've
yeah.
learned over time that it's not.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And there is no book today
yeah.
because the circumstances are different
yeah.
and changing on a regular basis.
So fast.
Yeah, honestly, that very much speaks to the, like, what if? People want to know. People want to know every single detail of everything.
Mm-hmm.
You're not always going to know. Like, again, parenting is going to be a lot of guesswork here and there. Like, there has
Trial
to be fluidity,
error.
100%. And that doesn't feel good. Like, because
right.
that is icky and anxiety-provoking. But it is also part of life and an
mm-hmm.
important piece.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I've been somewhat successful because I've always wanted to. Peter Pan was always my hero. I never wanted to grow up.
Perfect.
So by always having that youthful approach, well, yeah, I don't mind asking questions, even if they seem stupid.
It's
I'm
so
the kid.
Important.
It's okay.
It's so important like, to continue to learn and to be okay with not knowing, which is something that I really should take my own advice on. But I'm still working on that.
Well, there are opportunities for everybody.
Exactly.
You know?
We never stop knowing.
Yes. Well, that's one of the reasons I do these, because I'm still learning every single time I have one of these other conversations. It's like, oh, that's what that is? I didn't know.
To put the
but that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like I have learned so much from Dr. Cunell over the years. Again, I was her pre-doc in, I don't even remember what year at this point.
Years ago, pre-doc
in, you know, a neuropsychology fellowship. And then I did my postdoc with her. And again, I've been with her ever since she was the,
still here.
Since she was the matron of honor at my wedding. So she'll never get rid of me. But again, I think that what I've kind of learned over time is that you do have to keep learning. That one of the big pieces that kind of underscores our clinical work is ongoing research, like keeping up to date with things. Because I think we continually have cases that, you know, come across our desk where the details aren't set in stone, where things are evolving, where we do need to kind of say, like, you know, what do we now know about childhood bipolar? Because, again, the research is forever evolving. And I think we as clinicians make it a kind of a point of pride to ensure that we are up to date in what the research says.
That in itself is a challenge because so much research is still being done. And there's another press release or another research tomorrow, another study, but... Then you have to say, well, has it been peer-reviewed yet?
You got it. Bingo. Bingo.
That I've learned. Some people may should be aware of that.
Exactly. Yes. And what peers were reviewing it to begin with?
This is also follow the money.
Yeah.
Yes.
To kind of elaborate on that, the research-informed practice is a huge part of what we do. But kind of to your point about how long we've known each other, and to tie in your comment about Peter Pan and never wanting to grow up. I mean, there's the technical clinical work, there's the research, but at the heart of what we do also is connection. Like really getting to know just people for who they are and trying to help families sort of redevelop that connection with one another when something's kind of fallen apart. And to provide some context on where Dr. Ballou and I started years ago, she was my intern when I was working at another agency and we were running social skills groups for young children with autism. It was called Friendship Group, and it was an evidence-based, research-supported program to help these students develop some really like socially valid strategies for developing true reciprocal friendships with peers. It was a 14-week, well-structured program that ended with a party on the last day. And it was in the room next to my office, and probably 90 minutes or so before this party was about to start, I hear a whole lot of noise happening in the room next to me, and I go check it out, and it's Dr. Ballou decorating. She had balloons and streamers and was like really taking this party to the next level for these kids. And it was in that moment I knew that this was more than just a job for her. It was about connecting with these kids. And like, she's a fabulous clinician now, and I trust her wholeheartedly. Just the other day, I sent her a report and was like, please make sure I didn't write anything ridiculous in this. Like, we lean on each other.
You need that check.
To be fair, it was a fabulous report.
I worked really hard on it. But I think to do this job well, you need the technical expertise and the training. You need to stay sort of involved in the research and make sure you're up to date on what's truly best for our kids, but you also really have to be invested in getting to know people and supporting that connection with one another too. And I think that that's what has made us really successful with supporting families here.
The number of times where, again, our testing is scheduled for 2-3 hour blocks, the number of times where I have ended up adding a third session simply because I will spend a decent amount of time, again, particularly for teenagers, just talking to them.
Sure.
And honestly, the amount of clinical information and insight that comes from that, again, all of the tests that we do provide really solid information about how their brain works, etc. But the things that you can't get from a checklist is just talking.
Well, and to a certain extent, it's similar to what I do, and it's a stretch. Yes, clearly it's a stretch, but we're just having the conversation and getting some info. But I did, in the pre-research, I had some key questions, but you've now got a structure, 3 hours, and you're not going to get a person's life in 3 hours.
You can try.
But you're right, you're not
going to
get it all.
You're not. Yeah. And even if you get the second 3 hours, et cetera, that's a picture. But how complete is it? So if you have the opportunity, you know, that's where the serendipity moments just happen. It's like, oh, well, oh, yeah, okay, yes, let's go with this.
100%. And I think that that's where I think just clinical gut comes in. And I know that sounds like a flippant term.
It's a scientific term, but it's not scientifically proven yet that I found.
That's fair.
Yep. Everybody references, but I haven't seen that study
or peer review. That's very true.
Yeah, it comes with experience and again, just in true investment in getting to know these kids.
Right.
Really trying to understand people at their core.
Yes. They're people becoming the person they think they will be, but they're going to find out along the way. They're going to change along the way. Yeah. There was a little thing one of my daughters gave to me a few years ago. It was like, list your first 10 jobs. And it was like, okay, I have to think back on that. And then, but it was insightful because clearly, even when I started out and I said I was going to be the world's greatest English teacher, it was not a straight path.
Right. Yeah.
It was a rather crooked path. Yeah. If you look back at it, I can only look and make it straight now, looking back.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, I think that your path was slightly curvier than mine.
Yeah.
I mean, I went into undergrad and was immediately a psych major with a education minor, so I was a little more of a straight shot.
Okay.
Mine was a little crooked. I thought I wanted to study international politics, and that very quickly did not pan out. But I learned through exploring different classes just how much I loved working with kids. And for a while, I kind of debated special education versus school psychology, and eventually the psychology path, you know, really became clear to me.
Sure.
And it was definitely the right one. Like, I love my job so much.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to your point about this kind of being a snapshot in time, the evaluation absolutely is. But one thing we've been able to do over the past year with some changes in insurance billing in Massachusetts is we've started offering annual mental health wellness visits. And this is something I want families in Franklin and, you know, in surrounding towns to know. You don't have to wait for things to be really hard to get mental health care. The same way you take your child to the pediatrician for an annual physical, you can come see us or another provider for an annual mental health wellness visit. Mm-hmm. And we have an opportunity to do some baseline assessment and get some good preventative strategies in place to keep a close pulse on things to make sure that we can support students before things get really hard. And for students who are already experiencing more difficulties, who may have a diagnosis or a disability, who have already had an evaluation with us, we don't have to wait 3 years to see you for testing again. We can do checkups along the way. And that's been a really nice opportunity to see how kids grow and develop over time and to kind of follow that trajectory of them becoming who they will be. And it's been a really rewarding way to maintain relationships with families over time, too.
Because I think that ties back to, and I think now in the annual physical, they've got some number of questions that they ask you to kind of give them kind of a check in terms of, you might want to consider
something support.
Right.
Yep.
So while some people may have kind of made jokes about those specific questions, there's a reason for it, and clearly there's a need for it. And unfortunately, as we started talking, maybe there's not all the resources available, but the resources are starting to become available. Funding is starting to become available, so through the normal plans.
Yeah. Private insurance in Massachusetts is now required to pay for an annual mental health wellness visit as a preventative service. So the same way you don't pay for your annual physical, you don't have to pay for that yearly mental health exam either, which does make it more accessible for families.
Yeah, and then I think it's somewhat related, but the art pharmacy concept.
Yeah.
So art organizations can now give a ticket to a patient, call it, as part of their prescription or diagnosis and get reimbursed for it. So the art organization gets a paid ticket, but somebody as part of their process can, you know, explore whether it's a ballet or orchestra or go to an art museum or whatever. Franklin is one of the first communities to do that. And it seems to be taking off fairly well. So that's another aspect of this, I think, right?
Yeah, it's really interesting the different ways we're able to sort of expand opportunities for wellness and mental health support now. I think there's been so many changes, I feel like, over the last 15, 20 years with just how busy people's lives have become.
Sure.
And parents are exhausted and stressed. I mean, adults in general are busy and burnt out, and mm-hmm. that trickles down to our youth. I think in general, like, people, not just kids, but people are not engaging in enough play and not enough time outdoors and in nature. And those are really important experiences for our well-being. Mm-hmm. So to have an opportunity like the Art Pharmacy that can address mental health needs in that way, I think is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because at least then I know, and clearly as a reporter, it's sometimes tough times going to meetings and the topics are not necessarily great. I've got to make sense for it to pass it back to the rest of the folks. I need to do something on the side. So yes, I have an exercise program. I go walking a lot. So I walk by this building frequently.
Yeah. And that's how you found us.
I knew where you were. That was the easy part. Getting in was another story. Because it was after hours. And then I also write on the side. So I'm a quiet poet, which helps me evaluate and figure out. Because you learn, you think through writing.
Yeah.
You realize some things by writing them down that you wouldn't otherwise.
I wish that I could have that on repeat for some of the teenagers that I work with in terms of, like, how important journaling can be. Whereas mm-hmm. I get a lot of, yeah. So, again, louder for the people in the back that writing.
The recording will be available. I can take that snippet for you and put it on a separate drive.
Just 2 hours over and over and over again.
No, hobbies are so important. Just other activities beyond the day-to-day grind are so important for our mental health. And I feel like some of our kids aren't finding enough time for play. Even the way sports become so competitive so early, it begins to feel like a job for many, and school is...
Well, and the other comparison, and it was another book along the way, I know we connected on the Your Brain on Music, but the it's more structured.
Mm-hmm.
I could go to the playground
mm-hmm.
and play as a youth in my day.
Yeah.
And that was a few years ago. But kids these days are driven to, whether it's yoga or gymnastics or soccer or whatever, you just don't go down the street and play with the kids in the neighborhood.
No.
Maybe you do that as they come off the bus and they're playing on the way, but
there's not a lot of it. There really isn't.
No, there's not enough of it.
No, it's so much structured play, and
mm-hmm.
we know that unstructured play is really, really important for kids, not only for developing interpersonal skills, but also for, like, problem solving and conflict management and self-regulation.
I didn't get picked.
And that is okay.
Yes, it's so important, and I feel like kids are, I don't know if overscheduled is the right word or not. I think that's a pretty hot topic among
mm-hmm.
families.
Sure.
And, you know, people are entitled to have their own preferences for their family. For some, it is an issue of childcare, like needing their kid enrolled
Absolutely.
In activities so that they can do other things. And I understand that. But finding that time in some capacity for unstructured play
mm-hmm.
with
yes.
peers is really important. And
right.
I don't think that there's enough of it happening.
So it may be, if I paraphrase, so you do the evaluation, the testing, the analysis, and then talk with the parents and effectively try to work through them to create that kind of structure for the youth at whatever age it is, giving support to the parents so that they can be comfortable not knowing exactly
uh-huh.
what it's going to be and have that, you know, balance probably is an overused word in there, but some balance. You can have the unstructured time, structured time, choices in there, so you can learn from the choices and learn from the failures, and then go forward the next day.
And I will say, again, we, with all of that provided, it's not like we just deliver the information orally and then, you know, see you on your way. Families get all of that written up in a big, you know, massive long report that then they can use to obviously, you know, advocate for their child, whether it's outside resources, whether
mm-hmm.
it's, you know, ABA therapy
or school resources
or
whatever.
Exactly, school services, because that's also kind of a big piece of what we do. Because if you think about how much time a child spends at school, like, that is their day to day. That's where they get their self-esteem. That's where they get their social interaction. Obviously, we want the outside
peer interactions.
Exactly. Yes. But we really want schools to understand like who a child is. And I think many school districts, for their own testing, do a really good job of trying to hit on all of the different factors that make a child. Social, emotional, executive functioning, academic, intellectual. But I think one of the beautiful things that we can do is to kind of provide a much like broader, more comprehensive picture, which, again, our hope is really that teachers will be able to read our reports and say, like, I get it now. Like, this kid really needs... I've been giving him XYZ. He really needs PDQ. And it'll change that kid's whole world.
Yeah, because the teachers, having had experience with one who was many, many years kindergarten, she certainly wanted the right classroom so the kids could do those things and go. And then, of course, now she sees students come up, hey, Mrs. Sherlock, and she, who are you? You're not like, the kindergartner I could recognize.
It's good to see you again. You seem to have grown.
Changed a little bit.
Exactly.
Yes. But, and so the point there, the teachers in whatever grades want that.
Absolutely.
And they can get as much of it through their own resources, but if this can bring it in and that much more in science-based, et cetera, then they can work with that as well.
Absolutely.
And we really do love collaborating with schools and teachers as part of our evaluation, as long as we have consent from parents to do so. We solicit teacher input. We send out rating scales. We'll communicate via email. We will review school documentation. We want the school's perspective because that's where these kids are
part of the inputs into your process.
Exactly. Yeah. So we want to work with them, and we find their input so helpful. We also recognize that teachers are being asked to do so much.
And they just don't have one person. Sometimes it may be, you know, 15, 16, 18. Sometimes it's 20, 25. And, you know,
and
the attention time becomes a problem.
And with the number of kids who are struggling now, whether it's with learning disabilities or anxiety or attentional issues or classroom behavior problems, there's a lot happening in classrooms, and teachers are incredible. But I think at times often under-resourced, and
I know at least a few teachers who would say under-resourced.
And they're also expected to be available all the time via email for parent questions and comments and concerns, and it's just so much to ask of them. So whenever we can collaborate with them, both to get information from them about what they're seeing in their classrooms, but then also to try and give them as much helpful information as we can to support a student, we like to have that opportunity.
I really do think, I mean, obviously I work with many of our Franklin families from, you know, pre-K all the way through high school. I think Franklin District is so phenomenal. Like, you can tell from teacher input, from school documentation that we review, these teachers care. Like, they would not put in place the times, the efforts. Sometimes just like shooting in the dark, being like, you know what, I have whatever, 20 years of experience, and this XYZ has helped in the past. I'm going to try it with this student. But sometimes kids are just so complex that teachers are deserving of like, here's a much like clearer picture. Hopefully this helps. And again, so if we can give that to teachers, like, we are over the moon to do so.
It takes a village. It has been perhaps overused, but it's true. It does take a village. Diverse experience, diverse backgrounds, coming together, sharing, I saw this, you saw this, put it together. There it goes.
Exactly. Some of my favorite things are to kind of look at parent report data, teacher report data, and then teen report data. And because everybody has their own thinking. And when I put the pieces together, I'm like, well, here you go, and this is why things are happening. And the number of times where, you know, parents, teens, teachers are like, that makes sense. And people feel fulfilled and validated because we can give you an answer and direction, which is what you want from your provider.
And to do that in an individual household is rather challenging because the parents don't have your kind of training. Maybe some do, but not necessarily all of it. And it's generally that third party view is going to be the better view because it's kind of unbiased to that extent. So there's that comfort, well, and I'll listen to them.
Yeah, it's nice to hear from a third party. I mean, also, you can be the best clinician in the world, but at the end of the day, if it's your kids screaming at you at 8:30 at night, all your clinical skills might be turned down a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I say to families all the time, I have my mom hat and I have my psychologist hat, and sometimes I put on the wrong one. You can know all the right things to do and still do all the wrong things in the moment, because you're human and you have feelings and emotions and exhaustion. And so validating that for families and letting them know that they're not supposed to be an expert on all things child development. Parenting is such a personal process, and I think most parents put a lot of pressure on themselves to get it right, quote unquote.
To be perfect, starting out, and you're never going to be perfect.
You're never going to be perfect, and
keep trying.
yeah, and I think, especially with the internet and social media, it's not just our teens that are struggling with the pressure they get online, but parents, I think, also feel really pressured to do things a certain way, and it's not. It's not helpful to use that as your reference point. So we really do try to provide a different perspective to validate what families are going through, and to give them that sort of roadmap for moving forward, so that they have a framework to keep working from.
I don't know if it was you who said it, but at some point I came across the phrase, if parenting was GPS, it would just always say recalculating.
That's a good analogy. Figuring out a new direction. Something just changed, whether it was the news headline or the traffic in front of you. Now you're going to be late for Johnny's thing or whatever.
It's recalculating. But you will find a route eventually.
You will. You will get there, and it will still happen. You may be late, but it still will happen.
Exactly. 100% agree. I think I always feel like all of my quotes come from Dr. Cunell in one capacity. I can go through the file folder in my brain to say, is this a Dr. Cunell of 2018, 2019? What vintage?
What vintage, yes, yes.
You have such a great memory for these things. I say them and then they drift away, but she actually started recording me at one point. She'd come to ask me a question and say, wait, let me get my recorder.
This was for years. I would just walk in and just go click, and now I have a question for you. And she just got used to it, because there were a handful of times where I would come in, I would ask her advice, she would give me four perfectly poignant lines, and I would say, amazing, say it one more time. And she'd say, I don't know what you asked.
It's gone. I can't say it again. I just said it. It's gone. I know.
Yeah. I think she would ask me, I don't know, what did I say? It was brilliant, whatever it was.
We'll put it on pause and then hit replay, and here it is.
Exactly.
That's the aside on that is that's one of the learning tools that I do on a regular basis, because while I'm at a meeting, certainly I'm capturing notes. He said this, she said that, this is happening, this is the vote record. But then I'll proofread the recording the next day, and I'm finding other things that, oh, really? That happened? That's why they thought that, because they weren't following the same thread of thought that everybody else was on. It's like somebody goes to a meeting and nine people walk out of the room and they're all on, it was like nine different meetings. It's no wonder.
And that is the beauty of brains working differently, and why our job is so interesting, because people are complex and think in very unique, different ways.
Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think one of the things that, I don't know if you have found the same, we audio record usually our intake meetings and our feedbacks, because again, when we go to write the reports, we want them to be as comprehensive as possible.
Yeah.
I know I've learned a lot about my own clinical style just by having to hear my own voice back and say, oh, I need to, stop doing like sounds. So I've, learned to tailor my own style, but at the same time, I've also been better able to kind of pick up on cues that maybe I missed in the moments. So a parent who kind of makes a like, ooh, sound that I didn't realize I should have explained more at that point. So recording can be useful in so many ways.
Yes, kind of reliving. And I know at one point Google was doing the goggles and it was capturing everything, etc. But that was one side of the equation. It wasn't to what we're talking about, giving us the capability that, if we do a replay, what should we have done in that moment? A redo?
Absolutely.
It would
be the power
of
self-reflection.
Yeah.
Well, and the power of listening. There's a reason we have two ears and one mouth.
I love that.
Yeah, absolutely. again, I think I've learned a lot about myself in terms of what words I overuse, which astronomical, for whatever reason, is at the top of the list.
You may also notice a trend where certain words will come in and then disappear, and other words will come in and...
It's wild. Yeah. And then you become overly, you know, attuned to whatever you're saying,
right,
and forget the content.
Right.
That's always fun.
Yeah, yes.
That's why I take notes as well.
Yes. Well, we've had a wide-ranging, but I think following the thread, kind of a normal type conversation to that extent. So we started with where you were, started with how you got here, and then what you do and how you do it. Is there something else we haven't talked about?
So Dr. Ballou is being careful about how she asks this question, because I
have strong feelings.
I have strong feelings about screen time and just how technology is changing development for our kids.
Kind of a situation where if I go to a restaurant and four people are down at a table, but all four have a screen in front of them, that might be a symptom of something going on?
Potentially. I think there's been so many factors that have fueled the increase in time on screens for people in general, but especially for our kids. And I think to kind of highlight my concern in the clearest terms, we've spent, I think, a good year or two now as sort of a culture becoming increasingly aware of how social media has impacted our youth with respect to increasing anxiety and depression and suicide, not just intent, but actual suicide.
Correct.
There's clear evidence that social media and smartphones in the pockets of our teens has been directly correlated with an increase in these circumstances.
And for people, I'll play into where I think you're going, because it's there are studies saying that when Instagram became available and the phone had the two-way camera, 2013-14-ish is when things started really kind of going downhill from there.
Yes, there's been some very clear correlational research showing that sort of those features of self-comparison for our kids have been really harmful. And I feel like there's a lot of people now who acknowledge and recognize the role that social media has played in mental health. I think my concern as a professional, but also as a mom of young kids, is that we're now in this phase of using technology for so many other things, not just social media, but technology much more broadly. And there is research to show how it's impacting neurodevelopment, particularly with respect to attentional control and emotion regulation.
Right.
And that's not being talked about yet. And my fear is that 10 years down the road, we're going to look back, as we did at social media, and say that what we did has led to this epidemic of kids who cannot manage their attention and cannot manage their emotions.
Right.
And where we're in it now, I don't want to wait 10 years.
I want
change for our kids now, at home and in schools and in communities. So it's something that I am really passionate about. And while it's not the focus of all of our work here with families, but it is a huge part of kids' lives, and so it's something that often comes into the conversation when we're working with families about how to proactively support their development by limiting time on screens and really promoting outdoor play, sensory experiences, unstructured play, quality parent-child time off screens.
That as well, correct.
There's
yes.
so many things
even
that families
can do. Even board games or card games 100%. Or toys, you know,
100%.
Modeling or whatever, right?
Yes.
To clearly, in having reported over the years, I saw how budgets were getting cut and books were expensive, but now you could do a Chromebook and it was the cheaper to get the license, etc. But now you've put the screen as a requirement of the education.
Yes.
Because that's not necessarily good. And then the other piece is there's also research that says by writing, there's a kinetic
100%.
Wiring of the brain for writing. And yet during COVID, I started taking notes on my phone because I could do it quietly, and it wouldn't pick up the keystrokes on the recorder, and yet I'm wondering what I'm doing in my brain in the meantime.
Absolutely.
And the thing is, like, we know that these practices are not helpful for our kids, and in many ways they can be harmful. And when I read about policy that's happening in other places, I mean, there are other countries that are eliminating screens in K through five, like at the elementary level, no time on screens.
Right.
And I don't want us to be behind the wave and to have to look back 10, 15 years from now wishing that we had done something differently.
Things are dynamically changing, and yet the studies are there and clear, and how do we stem the tide?
And I think it starts so early, because one of the things, again, that's happening but isn't being talked about to a greater degree is displacement. So when it comes to emotional regulation, you know, little kids are all in the process of learning how to regulate. And the biggest way that they learn is through co-regulation, meaning that they're having a meltdown, a parent joins them, you know, let's take a couple deep breaths, or you know what, like, let's take a step away. You're teaching your child how to regulate. In many cases, when your child is melting down kind of more frequently and you're exhausted, you know, you have dinner boiling over on the stove, sometimes parents will, in their, you know, best efforts to help their child regulate, will say, you know what, go play one game on your iPad, take a couple deep breaths, and then come back. But what you're teaching is that the screen is the answer. Mm-hmm. So then when your child has a meltdown in public or in the absence of a screen, they don't know what to do with themselves.
Now what do I do?
They don't know how to exactly. And what I'm finding on the other end when it comes to adolescents, for, you know, some of my cases, my therapy cases, is kids will say, you know, I'm anxious, I don't know why. Like, all right, well, you know, talk to me. What was it that you were thinking about? I don't know. Well, how could you not know? I was scrolling on my phone. They're scrolling on their phone. Mm-hmm. I feel anxious. I don't want to feel that way. I'm going to lock in and just scroll. Well, we as clinicians, we want to help you, but if you aren't paying attention to your own thoughts, if you're continually deferring to a screen to say, la, 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 I'm not going to pay attention to those anxious thoughts, then there's no way that you're going to be able to change them. So we're seeing every developmental stage.
It starts in infancy, and this is truly no judgment. I think sometimes people, I mean, I think many people don't know the impact of these, you know, decisions yet, but it starts in infancy with the cell phones during diaper changes. You see all the time that parents will give their kid a cell phone to watch a video while they change their diaper so that there's no tantrums.
That's a recent development.
It happens often.
Ouch.
And it just starts so early, and it impacts this whole developmental process. So it's something that we're just really mindful of here in terms of how to give parents the knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
The encouragement to make some of these choices that can really support more positive.
So it may be a targeted question. At what age would be more appropriate for their first phone device? And I'll say device because it may or may not be a phone.
It's a great question. There's an organization called Wait Until 8th that I really love that we have supported here. We've got their flyer in the waiting room. We made a donation to them last year. And their sort of pitch is to wait until 8th grade for smartphone and to age 16 for social media. It doesn't mean you can't have a phone before then.
Sure. Yeah.
But it should be like a phone just for basic calling and texting, not the internet in your pocket.
Yeah.
But the way this organization works, and I would love for Franklin to pitch this more broadly, but the way it works is you sign this pledge as a parent and you write what grade your kid is in and what school they go to. So it could be Lincoln or Washington Street, third grade, fifth grade, whatever. And once they have 10 families in the same grade in that school, I think it's same grade, maybe it's the school in general, but once they have X number of families, they send you a roster. So you know what other families are aligned with you in these values, because the biggest pressure for parents is when their kids say, but everyone else has one.
Right, and then you can say, well, so-and-so doesn't, and they're doing the same thing we are.
Exactly, so to your point of it takes a village, I think the best way to address all of this is with like a community level approach,
yes,
where we
true.
Have
true.
Parents united in the free outdoor play, like mm-hmm. go to the park down
right.
the street and come
no.
back, you know, for dinner, and teachers and you know, school professionals who are aligned oh. in, you know, how we use educational technology in the classrooms, like
mm-hmm.
really just having
yeah.
a framework on a community
I'm
level.
I'm totally on board. We need to get to a community level conversation to solve so many other problems.
Yes.
Never mind
yes,
just parenting.
That's so true.
Because my solution, and I think I said it in my last talk, Franklin, with our town administrator, is just if we could take all the apps off the phone
mm-hmm.
and let it just be a phone and a text machine.
Yes.
Granted, that may be a wish thing, and I don't have the magic wand to do it.
The phones exist.
Yeah.
The phones exist. There are some really cool phones for kids that can do that now. There's even one called the Tin Can.
But I meant
phone.
For parents.
Oh,
because
for parents.
Oh, fair.
Yes.
That takes a lot of the diatribe and the vitriol on
yes.
various Facebook yeah. groups and not other places. It would just, you know, it wouldn't perfectly solve things, but it would get us
it
a
helped.
Step closer to having a one-on-one conversation.
100%.
Yep.
100%.
It's just something that people find so scary now,
mm-hmm.
talking
yeah,
face to face.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How do they do that?
It's wild, isn't it? Yeah, kids don't go just knock on their neighbor's door anymore. It's,
no,
you know.
Not very much
right.
anyway.
Yeah.
Text for us. Are you available? I'll come over.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's where parents then say, well, I don't want to socially isolate my kid.
Right.
And it's a push-pull, and to your
mm-hmm.
point, unless it's a
community
broader
level.
Community change.
Right.
That's where Wait Until 8th is really an amazing organization in trying to help schools and towns develop
mm-hmm.
a framework for shifting some of these
yeah.
practices.
I see a second episode coming because I hadn't heard about that. That has a place here, and
yeah.
I think we're going to have to develop that one.
Works for me.
It just might.
You give us prompts and we will talk. There are
and
no shortage of words.
And there's some others we could bring into the conversation to help build that community swell, if you will.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So thank you for adding that. That was a good one.
Okay, great. I can talk about the technology stuff for far longer than most people want to listen.
Uh-huh. Yes.
But I'm happy to try and
mm-hmm.
and spark that conversation because I think it's a really important one.
No, I agree for
yeah.
sure. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you both for this wonderful conversation. I've learned a bunch, and hopefully you listeners have as well. We're going to have to come back at least for the screen thing.
I would love that.
By all means.
I would love
that.
Thank you so much.
That could be its own entire show.
Yes.
Really
if not one of a series.
Yes.
Absolutely. Again, and thank you so much for coming and giving us a platform to kind of talk about the things that we care most about, that we're so passionate about, and we're really hopeful that, you know, listeners will have learned something as well.
Absolutely. This is the community service that the studio is fostering to amplify the public good, and there's good here.
Thank you.
So. No, thank you for doing it. It takes two to tango.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So as we close, quick reminder to the listeners, we do this because Franklin matters. We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008. And used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. And by the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.